Hey everyone, and welcome back. Are you ready to dive into something truly fascinating? Today, we're going deep into the world of social neuroscience.
Ooh, that sounds interesting.
It is, and it's all thanks to you, dear listener. You sent in some absolutely incredible material.
Yes, those excerpts were great.
I know, especially that social neuroscience guide. Seriously, when I saw that, I was so excited.
It is a fantastic resource for sure.
Right. I mean, we're talking about how our brains handle interacting with other people. It's like a secret code to understanding social situations.
And what's really mind-blowing is that there are entire networks in our brains dedicated to just that social interaction.
Whoa, hold on. Entire networks. So it's not just one part of the brain doing all the work.
Nope, not at all. It's a team effort. And to understand it, well, we need to meet the key players. Let's start with the prefrontal cortex.
Okay, the prefrontal cortex. I feel like I've heard of that before, but remind me.
Think of it as the brain's executive suite, you know, where all the big decisions are made.
Like the CEO of the brain.
Exactly. In social situations, the prefrontal cortex is what helps us keep our cool. You know, like when someone cuts you off in traffic,
Oh, yeah, been there.
instead of, immediately laying on the horn, our prefrontal cortex steps in and says, "Hold on, maybe they didn't see you."
So it's like our inner peacemaker.
It is. It helps us understand other people's perspectives, manage our own emotions, and choose how to respond in, shall we say, more civilized way.
So that's how we avoid road rage.
Got it. But what about those times when we do have strong emotional reactions, even if we try not to?
Ah, well, for that, we need to introduce the amygdala. This little guy is like the emotional watchdog of the brain.
A watchdog.
Yep, always on alert, scanning for anything that could be a threat or a reward. Like, have you ever gotten that instant feeling from someone's face that they're not happy?
Oh, yeah, for sure. You could just tell, right?
Right. That's your amygdala doing its job. It's helping us read the emotional landscape and react quickly.
Wow, it's like having a built-in emotion detector. It is. And it's not just about sensing danger either. The amygdala helps us feel those good vibes too. You know, the joy and excitement of connecting with someone we care about.
Okay, so the prefrontal cortex is the CEO making the decisions, and the amygdala is the watchdog alerting us to emotional cues. Who else is on this team?
There's one more I absolutely have to tell you about. The temporoparietal junction, or TPJ for short.
TPJ. Okay, I'm all ears. What does that one do?
Well, you could call it the mind reading zone.
Mind reading. Seriously. Okay, now I have to hear more about this.
Okay. I know it sounds a bit fantastical, but it's not magic, I promise. The TPJ is what allows us to consider other people's thoughts.
Like what they might be thinking.
Exactly. It helps us understand that their beliefs, intentions, their whole internal world might be completely different from our own.
So it's like understanding that someone might be smiling, but
Yeah.
actually be feeling nervous on the inside.
You got it. Or maybe that your friend is quiet, not because they're mad at you, but just because they're tired.
Oh, that makes so much sense. So TPJ is like the key to avoiding those awkward social misunderstandings.
Right. It's crucial for navigating those complex social situations and, well, basically having friends. And what's even more fascinating is that therapists are using this knowledge to help people.
Really? Tell me more.
They are using specific techniques that actually target and strengthen the TPJ, to help people who struggle with understanding social cues.
Wow. So it's like we're starting to decode the secrets of the social brain and use them to help people live happier lives.
Exactly. It's truly remarkable what we're learning.
Okay, before we move on, there's something I've always been completely fascinated by. Mirror neurons. Have you heard of these?
Of course, mirror neurons are one of the most exciting discoveries in
I
neuroscience.
know, right? So tell me, is it true that if I watch you reach for that coffee cup, the same neurons fire in my brain as if I were reaching for it myself?
You got it. It's like our brains are simulating the action we're observing.
That's wild. But it's not just about physical movements, right?
No, you're right. Scientists think mirror neurons are also a big part of why we feel empathy for others.
So, like, when I see someone crying and I start to feel sad too, is that my mirror neurons kicking in?
That's the idea. They create a kind of shared emotional experience. And you know what else?
What?
Mirror neurons are crucial for how we learn, especially in childhood. It's how we learn to imitate.
Ah, so that's how kids pick up language and social behaviors so quickly just from watching.
Precisely. And researchers are even looking at how to use this knowledge to improve teaching methods. It's all about harnessing the power of mirror neurons.
Now that's what I call putting science into action. Okay, so we've got this incredible social brain network, and we've got these amazing mirror neurons. But how do we actually make sense of all the emotional signals flying around out there in the real world?
Well, that's where our brain's amazing emotion decoding abilities come into play.
Oh, I like that. Emotion decoding.
Yeah.
Like we're all secret agents.
Haha. In a way, yes. We're constantly picking up on facial expressions, tone of voice, body language, all these tiny cues that tell us how someone is feeling.
So it's a whole body experience, not just what they're saying.
Exactly. It's a symphony of signals.
Okay, I'm loving this metaphor. So who are the conductors of this emotional orchestra? Which parts of the brain are doing the heavy lifting here?
Well, the amygdala, our trusty watchdog, is definitely involved. Remember, it's always assessing the emotional significance of things. But it's got help. Another key player is the insula.
The insula, that's a new one.
It is. And it's super interesting. The insula is closely connected to our internal bodily sensations. It's what gives us those gut feelings about things.
So like when you meet someone new and you just get a bad feeling about them, even though you don't know why.
That's the insula talking. It's that visceral, instinctual response. It's working with the amygdala to give us a full picture of the emotional situation.
Okay, got it. The amygdala assesses, the insula provides that gut check. What happens next? Does the brain just explode with all this information?
Thankfully, no. That's where the prefrontal cortex comes back in. Our executive function steps in to regulate our response.
Ah, so it's like the voice of reason again, keeping us from jumping to conclusions or overreacting.
Precisely. It helps us make sense of the emotional data, choose how to respond, and basically stay cool under pressure.
This whole process is incredible. Our brains are constantly running this emotional analysis without us even realizing it.
They are. And the more we understand these processes, the more skilled we become at navigating the social world. We can manage our own emotions better, build stronger relationships, and just, you know, generally be more awesome human beings.
You know what? I think you're absolutely right. This is already blowing my mind. I'm starting to see how knowing all of this could be so helpful in everyday life.
It truly can be.
Okay, I'm ready for more. Mm-hmm. Tell me everything about empathy.
All right, empathy it is. But first, let me tell you, there's more to it than meets the eye.
Ooh, intriguing. I'm all ears.
You see, we often talk about empathy as this one big thing, but it's actually a bit more nuanced.
Oh, okay, I'm listening.
So there are two main types of empathy. First, we have cognitive empathy.
Cognitive empathy, and that is?
It's about understanding another person's perspective. You know, like putting yourself in their shoes, trying to see things from their point of view.
So kind of like figuring out the why behind their actions or emotions.
Exactly. It's that aha moment when you suddenly get why someone reacted a certain way, even if you wouldn't have done the same thing yourself.
Got it. And the other type of empathy?
The other type is called affective empathy. And this one is more about actually feeling what the other person is feeling.
Oh, so like if you see someone who's really sad, you start feeling sad too.
You got it. It's like your emotions are mirroring theirs.
Wow, that makes sense, especially with those mirror neurons we were talking about earlier.
Right. It's like our brains are wired to create a shared emotional experience. And both types of empathy are super important for building strong connections with other people.
So cognitive empathy helps us understand each other, and affective empathy helps us feel connected emotionally.
Exactly. It's a powerful combination. But where does compassion fit into all this?
Yeah, good question. I feel like empathy and compassion often go hand in hand, but they're not exactly the same thing, are they?
You're right, they're not. Compassion takes empathy a step further. It's not just about understanding or feeling someone else's suffering. It's also about wanting to help, to do something to alleviate that suffering.
So it's like empathy plus action.
You could say that. It's empathy and action, turning that understanding and feeling into something positive. And what's truly amazing is that research suggests we can actually cultivate compassion, almost like training a muscle.
Wait, really? So it's not just about being a naturally compassionate person. We can actually learn to be more compassionate.
Exactly. There are practices like compassion meditation that can actually change the structure and function of our brains, making us more empathetic and compassionate people.
Wow, that's incredible. So it's not just about being a nice person. It's about training our brains for kindness.
You got it. And the benefits go beyond just feeling good. Studies show that people who practice compassion experience less stress, more happiness, and even better physical health.
And that's what I call a win-win. Okay, I have to ask about something else that's always blown my mind. Theory of mind.
Ah, theory of mind. It truly is remarkable. It's our ability to understand that other people have their own unique thoughts, beliefs, and intentions.
So like realizing that not everyone sees the world the same way we do.
Precisely. And this ability is crucial for navigating all those complex social situations. You know, like Without theory of mind, we wouldn't be able to anticipate how someone might react to a joke.
Or understand why someone's upset.
Exactly. We wouldn't even be able to have a normal conversation. We'd be constantly misinterpreting each other's actions and intentions.
Oh, I can see how that would lead to some serious social awkwardness.
For sure. Theory of mind is like the secret code that allows us to decipher the unspoken rules of social interaction. And this ability usually develops around ages 4 to 5 in children.
So by the time they hit kindergarten, they're already starting to understand other people's minds.
They are. It's a gradual process, of course. But that's when we start to see those more complex social interactions and pretend play emerging.
That's so fascinating. So as we grow up, our theory of mind just keeps getting more and more sophisticated, allowing us to navigate those increasingly complex social situations and build stronger relationships.
You got it. And it's not just about our personal lives. This understanding of theory of mind is having a huge impact in fields like mental health.
Oh, right, because so many mental health challenges involve difficulties with social interactions and relationships.
Exactly. And therapists are using this knowledge to develop really effective treatments. Like, one approach that's gaining a lot of traction is mindfulness-based therapy.
Mindfulness. I've heard a lot about that. How does that tie in with social neuroscience?
Well, mindfulness teaches people to become more aware of their thoughts and feelings, you know, in the present moment without judging themselves. And this can actually change the way the brain responds to stress, especially social stress.
So it's like learning to observe your thoughts and feelings without getting swept away by them.
Precisely. And studies have shown that this can be incredibly helpful for people with social anxiety. They learn to approach social situations with less fear and more confidence.
Wow, so it's not just about relaxation. It's about rewiring the brain for better social interactions.
Exactly. It's about empowering people to take control of their social experiences. And there are other therapies that draw on social neuroscience, too, like social skills training.
Social skills training. What's that all about?
Well, it uses things like role-playing and feedback to help people develop specific social skills. Things like starting conversations, understanding nonverbal cues, even resolving conflicts effectively.
So it's like giving people the tools they need to succeed in social situations.
Exactly. And it's not just for people who struggle socially. Anyone can benefit from learning how to communicate better, build stronger relationships, and just feel more comfortable in social settings.
I love that. It's about giving everyone the opportunity to thrive in their social lives.
It is. And speaking of thriving, let's shift gears for a moment and talk about how social neuroscience is changing the way we think about education.
Okay, I'm all ears.
One of the most exciting things happening in education is the shift toward more collaborative and interactive learning environments. You know, instead of just sitting in a lecture hall, passively absorbing information.
Oh, yeah. Group projects, discussions, hands-on activities, that kind of thing.
Exactly. And the shift is happening because we're starting to understand, thanks to social neuroscience, that our brains are actually wired to learn from and with each other.
Makes sense. I mean, we've talked about mirror neurons and how we learn through imitation. It seems natural that learning in a social setting would be way more engaging.
It is, and it's not just about mimicking. When we learn together, we're exposed to all these different perspectives. We can bounce ideas off each other, challenge each other's thinking. It just makes the learning process so much richer.
So ditch the boring lectures and embrace the power of collaboration.
Exactly, and the research backs this up. Students who learn in these social interactive environments, they tend to be more engaged, more motivated, and they learn better. They develop better critical thinking skills, better communication skills, and they build those all-important social and emotional skills along the way.
Wow, that's fantastic. So it's like we're finally moving away from that old model of education where the teacher is the only source of knowledge and students are just passive recipients.
We are. Social neuroscience is showing us that learning is best when it's active, engaging, and yes, social.
I love it. It's like we're finally tapping into the true potential of the human brain. And speaking of potential, I bet social neuroscience has a lot to say about how we can create more productive and fulfilling work environments.
You bet it does. Companies are finally starting to realize that understanding the social brain can lead to happier, more engaged employees and stronger teams.
Okay, I'm all ears. Tell me everything. How are companies using social neuroscience to improve the workplace?
Well, for starters, there's a big emphasis on emotional intelligence these days.
Emotional intelligence. That's about understanding and managing emotions.
Yeah.
Both our own and other people's.
You got it. And it's crucial in the workplace, you know, for communication, teamwork, leadership. All of it.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, a leader who can read a room, you know, understand what their team is feeling and respond effectively, that's going to be a more effective leader.
Exactly. And thanks to social neuroscience, we now have ways to actually measure and develop emotional intelligence. There are assessments to figure out someone's strengths and weaknesses and training programs to help people build those skills, things like active listening, empathy, giving feedback.
So it's like giving people a roadmap for becoming more emotionally intelligent, which makes them better communicators, better leaders, better team players.
Precisely. And it's not just theory. The research shows that these interventions really work. People who go through emotional intelligence training, they report better teamwork, higher job satisfaction, and even lower stress levels.
Wow, that's impressive. So are there other ways companies are using social neuroscience to create better workplaces?
Absolutely. There's a growing awareness of the importance of psychological safety.
Psychological safety. I haven't heard that term before.
It's about creating a work environment where people feel safe to speak up, share their ideas, take risks, you know, without fear of being punished or humiliated.
Oh, that sounds crucial for innovation.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you're always worried about making a mistake, you're not going to be very creative.
Exactly. And social neuroscience is showing us why that is. When people feel safe to express themselves, the amygdala, that part of the brain that's always scanning for threats, it's less active. And that frees up mental space for creativity and collaboration.
That makes so much sense. So instead of feeling threatened, people feel empowered to contribute their best ideas.
Precisely. And companies are using this knowledge to design workplaces that foster psychological safety. You know, they encourage open communication. They celebrate mistakes as learning opportunities. They create a culture where everyone feels valued and respected.
Now, that's the kind of company I'd want to work for. It seems like social neuroscience is giving us the tools to not just understand our social brains, but to actually use that knowledge to create better lives for ourselves and for each other, whether it's in our personal relationships, in our schools, or in our workplaces.
Absolutely. And we're just scratching the surface of what this field has to offer. There's so much more to learn, and the possibilities are truly endless.
You know what? I'm already completely blown away by everything we've covered. But before we get too carried away with all the possibilities, maybe we should take a moment to recap some of the most mind-blowing takeaways from our deep dive into social neuroscience.
Sounds like a plan. What has stood out to you the most so far?
Well, for me, one of the biggest takeaways has been realizing just how much our brains are wired for connection. It's not just a nice idea. It's like literally how our brains are built.
Absolutely. I mean, think about it. We have these complex neural networks devoted to social processing, those incredible mirror neurons that let us share experiences. Our brains are constantly searching for and responding to social cues.
And it's not just about the hardware, right? It's like our social experiences actually change our brains.
Exactly. That's one of the most amazing things about social neuroscience. We're not stuck with the brains we're born with. We can actually rewire them through our experiences, our interactions, our relationships.
That's so empowering. It's like we're all architects of our own brains.
I love that analogy. We are. And this understanding has huge implications for mental health, education, the workplace. It's changing everything.
Yeah, we've seen some incredible examples of that. Therapists using mindfulness to help people manage social anxiety. Educators creating collaborative learning environments, companies prioritizing emotional intelligence and psychological safety. It's like we're taking this knowledge and using it to make the world a better place.
We are. And we're just getting started. There's still so much to discover, so much potential to unlock.
I'm already amazed by how much we've learned. But before we get too carried away, there's one thing we haven't touched on yet that I think is really important. Social media. How is all this technology affecting our social brains?
Oh, yes. Social media. It's fascinating, really. A kind of real-time experiment on how our brains adapt to a rapidly changing social landscape.
Right. On one hand, social media can be so powerful.
Yeah.
Connecting with people, sharing information, building communities.
Absolutely. But on the other hand, there's this growing concern about, well, the downsides. The potential for addiction, the way it can distort our view of reality, even erode our empathy and social skills.
A double-edged sword.
It is. You see, social media platforms, they're designed to keep us hooked. And they do that by tapping into our brain's reward system. Every notification, every share, it triggers a little burst of dopamine.
Dopamine, that feel-good chemical.
Exactly. And our brains love it, so we keep coming back for more, even if it's not really good for us in the long run.
It's like we're sacrificing real connection for quick hits of online validation.
That's a great way to put it. And it's not just the amount of time we spend online, it's also the quality of those interactions. Social media often presents this, well, idealized version of reality, Perfect photos, perfect lives.
And that makes it hard to, appreciate our own messy, imperfect lives.
It does. It can lead to comparisons, feelings of inadequacy, even anxiety and depression. It makes it harder to be kind to ourselves, to embrace our flaws.
So what's the solution? Do we all need to just, ditch social media completely?
Well, that's certainly one option, but I think a more realistic approach is to be more mindful about how we use it. Set limits on our screen time, be more selective about what we consume, and make a conscious effort to engage in more meaningful interactions, both online and offline.
So it's about taking control, being intentional about how we use these platforms.
Exactly. And remembering that true connection. It happens in those face-to-face moments. The shared laughter, the deep conversations, the simple act of being present with another human being.
It's about putting down the phone, looking up from the screen, and engaging with the world around us.
Exactly. Don't underestimate the power of those everyday interactions. A smile exchanged with a stranger, a heartfelt conversation with a friend. Those moments are what truly nourish our souls.
I love that. Those small moments of connection can make such a big difference. Well, I think this has been an incredible deep dive into the world of social neuroscience. Thank you so much for sharing your expertise with us.
It's been my pleasure. This is such a fascinating field, and I'm always thrilled to talk about it.
And to our amazing listener, thank you for sending us such thought-provoking material. We hope you've enjoyed this exploration of your incredible social brain.
Keep learning, keep connecting, and remember, you have the power to use your brain to create a more compassionate and connected world.
That's it for this episode. We'll see you next time for another deep dive.